This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
Though some folks says that the devil's dead, though some folks says that...
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Memphis, Tennessee. Right now we're here with Faith Morris at the
National Civil Rights Museum.
Yeah.
Yes, it opened in 1991, and in 2014 we did a major renovation to really expand on the story. The museum was a phenomenal institution all along, but we wanted to make it more immersive. We also wanted to make sure that slavery was the first experience, because we really felt that slavery was the early instance of civil rights infringements. And this exhibit really does tell the story of a culture of resistance, the story of slavery from 1619 to 1861. We wanted to make sure that folks really got how treacherous the voyage was from that middle passage over to America. And so we have these little trails on the floor so that you could track what was going on as slaves were brought over.
You obviously have a lot of school groups that come here.
Always have a museum full of young people.
And so in which ways does it become most palpable and real for these kids that come here? The slavery and the transportation.
The history books don't go into enough detail.
Wow.
You know, it's so top-lined if it's talked about at all. The areas that really need to be focused on, the ones that were most transformed, were the ones that really changed this country and really led to changes in the world. And so when they come here, and yes, they've heard of slavery, but they never, and I can't say it's just the kids. We have plenty of adults that are saying, wow, I had no idea. And that's why we spent so much time in this first exhibit, to really help folks understand that slavery lasted so long because it was the backbone of the country. If you didn't have slavery, the whole economy would fall. The slaves built commerce during that time. So they held on to it as long as they could because they needed to have an alternative to get that work done, right? And it also, folks really don't understand that it lasted 366 years. There was almost 13 million Africans brought across the Atlantic Ocean, and it was the largest forced slave movement, you know, in the world. So telling that story.
What are the things that most get them and that they connect with?
When they come in here, and we left that little space behind, you know, so they could crouch down and see how uncomfortable it was. And they said, wow, I just don't know. And then we tell them to listen to the voices of the slaves, and you could hear the anguish and the tears and the sadness, but you could also hear that there was a communication that they had. This was the beginning of this whole music and chanting that went through the centuries of, you know, being able to communicate in a way that only they understood, so that their masters didn't know what they were talking about. And then also to help them understand slave trade and how the families were torn apart, how babies almost first born were taken away from their moms. How husbands and wives didn't get to spend much of their lives together, if they got to spend any of it together again after they were separated, and how brutal it was, and how amazing that any of them got through it. They were not allowed to read. They didn't want them to talk and communicate, because they did understand that there's power of connection. And so they really kept them as part, they kept them at odds, they kept them fighting, you know. And they persevered through all of that. They snuck and they read and they created their own languages. And they stripped them of their names, you know, so that they would have nothing that was of their former life before they got here. And that they reclaimed so much of that. And because of that, those that could grew stronger.
And even in more recent history, you know, 1800s, there were some slaves that became incredible leaders and brilliant educators. Talk to us about some of your favorite characters.
Well, let me tell you, Harriet Tubman is my absolute favorite. Harriet Tubman is the mama and the leader of all of the slavery movement. She created this Underground Railroad. And, you know, you have to explain to folks that it's not a train, you know. It truly was a movement that took slaves from house to house, to abandoned places, underground in holes, you know, wherever they could get some safety.
You've read a lot about her. Do you have that feeling that you know her?
Oh, I think I know her and I love her. There's one statement that she said that actually transcends some of what I think about today is, I freed thousands of slaves, but I could have freed thousands more if they knew they were slaves. She was a very smart woman. Mm-hmm. She had to be brilliant to do what she did in the first place and very brave to do what she did.
Mm-hmm. Can you hear her voice, feel her sense of personality?
I can. I get so involved in trying to understand what was in their head at the time to see what in the world would I do. Would I have been able to endure any of it? And, you know, I think I'm a fighter, but I don't know if I could fight that hard. That's hard work, and you have to be fearless. I'm fairly fearless. This woman was capital F fearless, you know. She went against everything that was going against her to free, to make the decision not just to get herself out, because clearly she was smart enough to do that.
It goes without saying that she was a threat to certain people, too.
She was a threat to all of those that wanted to keep slavery intact.
So it's amazing that she wasn't killed.
It is amazing. It is amazing, but she carried a shotgun, so she wasn't afraid to shoot anybody who came. She was as treacherous as the slave masters.
Wow.
Just for the other side.
Tough
right?
critter.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Interesting. When I was with you last time, you mentioned something about lynching.
Yes.
And you mentioned something, you said lynching still goes on today.
Oh my goodness, and if you Google it, there are recent stories now.
Mm-hmm.
There are stories of blacks that, and well, people of color, I don't know that I can say that it's exclusive to just blacks now, but folks are using that still as a way of hushing a community, of giving a threat that, you know, I need you to stay in your place. The whole lynching thing, if you'll notice that slavery has come back so folks can understand better what that is, because it explains a lot of what's happening now, why people do and feel the way they do. And then lynching. The story of lynching and understanding lynching has become a huge, huge, huge topic because of how inhumane as slavery was, and I still think is the most treacherous. Lynching was almost entertainment, that they would hang a young man or a young woman or an old man or old woman or a child. And they would, it was as if they were going to the movies.
Yeah,
they had refreshments,
bring the family.
Oh, God, we got a lynching today. Both got excited, and the word went through the community of, you know, just, wow, isn't that good? You know, and they sat there and they watched that person wrenching right until they died, hanging from, you know, and then they went on. They left him hanging there.
Yeah.
They didn't even pull him down, you know, to have some kind of dignity in death. So understanding what kind of mind would do what they did during slavery and do what they've done through lynching. And I'm saying that lynching still exists, not in the way that it was.
It takes a different form.
But. Well, it's not a party anymore. Right. It's a sneaking around and doing it.
But even pretty blunt and blatant, I mean, driving while black.
All of that.
I mean, that's
all
unbelievable.
That. There's a significant target on especially black men. And it's a way, almost the way it was in slavery, almost the way it has been through war, where you tear the male influence away. And as strong as women are, and frankly, I think we can do anything. But to not have a total family unit is not the best way for young people to get a sense of what family is, although there's loving and, you know, lots of sisters and aunties and grandma and all of that. But it's an intentional way of not having what's considered normal.
Let's go to one of your favorite areas.
Come on, let's go this way. This actually is one of my, other than slavery, because I think slavery is absolutely a favorite of mine. But this combating Jim Crow is something. I can't tell you how many folks say, now who was Jim Crow?
Right.
And we say, no, Jim Crow was not a person. It was oppressive laws. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, during Reconstruction, there were some strides that were made. You know, it was amazing to come from slavery. And then, you know, after that, anybody had the gumption to try to open a school or become a lawyer or a doctor or do some black media.
That was a threat.
It was a threat. So along came Jim Crow to shut all that down. And so the images in this exhibit, where we have to be reminded of what the Klan meant then and now. The Klan has not gone anywhere. They just are wearing suits and ties. They have actually gotten back in some instances to their regalia.
Putting the hoods and the sheets on.
Yeah, to start doing it because they're very proud. They used to hide. Now it's okay to show hate. It's okay to have symbols of hate.
They've actually been encouraged by certain people.
They have.
Yeah.
No need to hide. You're a strong force. Mm-hmm. You know, do what you do. Yeah. And they're doing what they do. The issue is that now you're infiltrating our police and fire and doctors, and, you know, we're surrounded in different ways.
Yeah.
And this one that just talks about how folks were owning their own land and, you know, shaping the future. Education took a very different tack. And then I get, it's like this, a stop.
Yeah.
And I see this, about what happens when folks try to vote.
Mm-hmm.
How deadly it was to even let folks know that you were trying to register to vote. We're going to get to one of my favorites as we go through, Fannie Lou Hamer, who, after Harriet Tubman, is Fannie Lou.
It's hard to look at.
It is hard to look at, but it's absolutely what was going on. And this is not an isolated incident.
And that's not that horribly long ago in history.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not. No.
And it's still going on today.
It is absolutely going on today. That's what is so frightening and dangerous about what's happening in society, is that some of the worst of our history is coming back in full force.
And what are these photos about right here? Is that W. Dubois right there? Isn't that him up there?
Yeah. No, that's Booker T. Washington.
Oh, yeah, Booker T, yeah.
Up there.
And then he's with Roosevelt?
See, Booker T. Washington was the one who said, y'all need to stop all this fighting and go to school.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be educated. Don't be ignorant so that you can know what's right and wrong from a, you know, a mental standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
W.B. Dubois said, what? We need to fight. Frederick Douglass, we need to fight. You know, they didn't believe in that. They thought Booker T. Washington was bougie, you know, what we call bougie now, that he was an elitist, that he didn't put his feet on the ground and work, you know, against the movement, that he was too soft, too heavily educated and pushing, you know, a soft science instead of fighting back.
Yeah, that would be like Malcolm X, that same.
Malcolm and Martin. Absolutely. But what's interesting, though, is, you know, Malcolm was an eye for an eye. He truly believed in that, you know, by any means necessary. If that meant violence and brutality, do it. If that's what it takes to get it, do it.
Right.
And, of course, Dr. King was nonviolent. Well, they kind of switched places as they got older. Dr. King was tired of being nice. You know, he was an orator, a great preacher.
Mm-hmm.
He had gone through everything. He had gone through two presidents. He had gotten the civil rights movement done. He had gotten the voting rights movement done. He had worked hard to get that. But toward the end, he had lost his supporters.
Mm-hmm.
The organizations that had been behind him were not with him because he dared to talk about Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And so government turned on him in a different way. Because as slavery was the backbone of the economy then, war has always been a big economic push.
So being anti-war, he became a major threat.
It turned a corner when he became anti-war. And what he said was he understood war, but not how war was used to tear the black family apart and how war was used to kill these boys over there when they were fighting for a country who didn't fight for them. And it wasn't a fair position. And we outnumbered, you know, we were disproportionately recruited not even recruited, mandated
exactly.
to show up.
Drafted. And then the middle class white boys all had their deferments.
All kinds of excuses, all kinds of ways, the safety net.
Tell me about this photo here. It's a photo of a parade, looks like maybe 1920s, and there's a large sign, "The New Negro Has No Fear."
Well,
where is this? What was happening?
I'm not sure where this is, actually. But what it is, it's representative of what was going on during this time, though.
But that's some pretty gutsy action right
there. But there was a lot of that going on. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of that going on. It happened in the South. Mm-hmm. It happened in the North. It was a pushback in the South.
That's in the height of the lynching era they were talking about. And yet mm-hmm. these people had the guts to stand proud in the middle of a giant parade.
Well, they made their own parade. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the movement did was we used signage in a way that hadn't been used anywhere. If you look at all of these images, you see that we tell you exactly what we're fighting for, exactly what's on our mind. You don't have to try to figure it out.
In this parade here, they look like suffragette mm-hmm. outfits. Mm-hmm. Is that what that?
These are the women, the wives, the mothers. These are the women that were fighting to support their husbands for independence. You know, the first blood for American independence was shed by a Negro, Crispus Attucks. Uh-huh. You know, and it talks about the power of the women's movement to support their men, to support what's happening, mm-hmm. you know, during that time.
So it's interesting. If you think about it, there's multiple layers. Right. They're the whole feminist issue, mm-hmm. issues of civil rights.
Yeah. I mean, the country didn't believe in it then. There are more amendments to the Civil Rights Act than there is of anything. Because each time, the first one should have taken care of it. Then somebody else, another legislator, would come and say, well, you know, they're not doing it. The one that was the most famous for adding an amendment was Edward Kennedy, who said, this is crazy. You know, we got to strengthen it again. You know, we got to put more in it because they're not doing it. That was part of Dr. King's frustration was, you know, the civil rights movement was the most successful in that it included legislation and litigation. No problem going to court. Let's get a bill that supports it. Let's get the highest in the land, the president, to understand
what's
going on.
What you're talking about is the 1960s, which was a really profound decade
in
movement, and there really hasn't been any period of time since then quite as intense.
No. It was the most violent movement. Mm-hmm. We still don't know how many people were killed in the movement because a lot of it wasn't documented, you know. And until Dr. King came along, and this is why he is such a smart man, he wanted to make sure that media started capturing some of this because all this violence and terrorism was going on just in the neighborhoods. You know, so all folks knew about it were the folks that were around it. Mm-hmm. But it didn't get outside right. that small area.
So that really, of all things, was the game changer.
That exactly.
Just finding that way to get it on the national news and get the word out.
Yeah. In Montgomery, and you know, folks need to understand how powerful women were in Montgomery. It was the most successful economic boycott that there was. They shut down the Montgomery transit system.
Why did it happen in Montgomery, Alabama? Is there any explanation?
Why Montgomery?
Yeah.
It's because you just had some women in Montgomery that just wasn't going to take it. You know, mad as hell ain't going to take it anymore.
Right.
Well, the issue was all over, but the NAACP in Montgomery apparently was very strong. Rosa Parks, I mean, they had been, this whole wall is talking about how Rosa was not the first one mm-hmm. to not give up her seat, but she was the most validated one mm-hmm. to give up her seat. She was an officer in the NAACP. She was a secretary. She was an intelligent woman. She was well-respected. She wasn't a child. Some of them were young. Mm-hmm. Some of them, you know, didn't have position in the community, and she did. And so the day she decided not to was the day that this really got the news. And this is also in Montgomery is when Dr. King was brought to town. And he was brought to town because they said, we need somebody new. Because they're not respecting these folks. They ain't going to do it. They're not going to change anything based on what they're saying. Yeah, we got Rosa, and that was a smart thing. But we got to get somebody in here that can move this thing along.
But what's interesting about that brain trust and those people at that point in time, what they figured out was their economic power.
Oh,
right.
They figured it out.
Yeah.
They walked. They took their babies. They walked to work. They walked to church. They walked their children to school. I love these statues in here because it shows these women doing their thing, showing how I'm sure they would love to sit down and take a ride.
But that being said, and it being so palpably clear at that time and place, I guess my question would be, why isn't there more kind of strategizing today of that potential economic power of influence by boycott, etc.?
That is a million-dollar question, isn't it?
It is.
That's an interesting question because you have folks not any less mad now than they were then. But I'll say we've gone a little soft in that these folks gave up everything to do what they needed to do. You know, we don't necessarily give up everything. I see.
So there's just enough of kind of those comfort things to make it.
I'm going to take you to something that's going on in fashion where you have, you know, Gucci doing blackface. You have another one doing a noose that's a necklace. And folks have said, you know, folks were pissed. They were just really infuriated about it. And then you got something that says, you know, I'm wearing my stuff. Well, now, what kind of sense does that make? That they have totally shown disrespect for what has been an issue and going to make light of it through fashion. And we still don't give up on that? Now, we had lots of angry voices. I know I put my stuff up. I got plenty of it. But I will not be treated like that. But if as many of us stop doing, because we disproportionately spend most of these brands, build their business on black shoppers.
So again, you understand, you get it, that that power is here and now, that kinetic energy, but somehow it hasn't been kind of connected or put together.
Well, what's interesting about it, though, that's different now than it was then, is there have been public statements and public protest and media protest and kind of intellectual protest and, you know, thrashing in social media and have gotten apologies from brands. Oh, you know, it was not our intention. Well, that wasn't happening then. There were no apologies happening in the 50s and 60s for bad doings. You know, it just went away or it kept going. And now, because they do recognize that this shopper not supporting you is a big dent in your business, too big a one for you to ignore. So those that are misbehaving and doing what is so unnecessary, going out of your way to do stupid stuff, have apologized for that. So I guess that is, in some respects, you know, a change. But you're right. I wish that it amazes me how many Mexicans voted for our president. And he started his whole campaign about blocking them. And, you know, he kept on and kept on and kept on. And then they voted for him. It's like, what in the world is going on? So who knows what goes in our minds that keeps us from doing what we need to do against people that do things against us. I mean, what, you know, what is that?
Talk to me about the Green Book. I understand that you have a presentation or something coming up.
The Green Book has always been important. It's amazing how many folks don't know about it. And then it's not amazing. One, because it was supposed to be quiet among this community so that when they could use it and not be terrorized because they were using it.
The Green Book has a connection with your own life when you were a little girl.
Well, the whole reason that there is a Green Book is because blacks could not travel through the South. They couldn't stay at hotels. You know, we know they've been fighting to get into restaurants and zoos, you know, public places.
Beyond the Deep South, I remember a story you told me, I think it was Tucumcari.
You have a good, yeah.
New Mexico.
Well, it was because, no, we were traveling to California.
Mm-hmm.
We always took these big trips. And we were traveling to California, and we needed to spend the night. And we had to go out of our way to find somewhere to go. And I was asleep, honestly, and when I woke up, I was a little girl, we were in Tucumcari, New Mexico. And I'd never heard of that. I didn't even know what Mexico is. I mean, like I say, I was a little girl. And we ended up in this trailer. Well, I thought it was the coolest thing in the world.
Because
you were
a kid.
We had this whole thing to ourselves. Mm-hmm. But the reason we did is that we weren't allowed in the hotel that this trailer was in the back of.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we stayed. That piqued my interest later. You know, I remember that and, you know, why that happened. And so when I get a chance to think about what the Green Book represented, at that time it was called the Negro Traveler's Guide, mm-hmm. you know, the Green Book. And the Lorraine Motel, which is where the National Civil Rights Museum is built around,
mm-hmm.
was one of the few hotels in the hotel motel in the Green Book.
Was it more than just hotels and motels?
Oh,
was
it was gas stations.
And
there's so many different versions of it. Mm-hmm. It grew and grew and grew. They started in the 1961 and 63 one. We had an ad, you know, the Lorraine Motel had an ad, come have, you know, food, because it was always a thriving place during
mm-hmm.
that time. But yeah, it truly became a magazine that helped you with any of what you were trying to do. And let you know where you could go. It had restaurants, gas stations. It had movie theaters. It had, you know, just any kind of thing that potentially would help us along as we were traveling.
Do you know where it was based? Was it a private business? Was it one guy that started it?
Yeah. No, in New York. I wish, and I should get you one. But in New York is where the Green Book started. There was this one man that decided that it was very important because of what was going on,
mm-hmm.
that blacks were not able to do the most simplest of things while traveling. He created this little book, and it gave the few that were allowed then, you know, and it kept growing as folks understood, as these hotels and motels and restaurants learned about the Green Book. It got bigger and bigger and more fancy. And included more than hotels. You know, it included gas stations.
So the parallel would be like the AAA.
It absolutely was the first AAA. It really was.
Mm-hmm.
And it was for the same intentions that AAA exists, is to help you with your travel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, AAA doesn't exist because we can't do this, but this one did. Most folks didn't know about it because it was a little secret among the black community.
What was the threat? Why did they want to keep it quiet?
Because you could not stay anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, folks used to think that blacks stayed with each other because we just loved each other and wanted to hang out with our families. You know, we'd go from city to see where we could stay. But that whole concept, it came from needing to find a safe place to stay. When Dr. King was traveling, he very seldom stayed in hotels. He would stay at the homes of folks in the cities and communities as he was
but
going.
But they wanted to host him, too.
Well, they wanted to, but he also was a man that was trying to get some work done.
Right, right.
So as much as he loved soul food and the care that they gave him,
mm-hmm.
When he came here, he stayed at the Lorraine.
And there's an interesting dynamic of the Lorraine, I remember you telling me about, in that it was a place where a white person could come
right.
and hang out.
Well, it was one of the few where the races could mix.
Yeah.
You know, usually it was, you know, it was all white. You had black folks working and cooking and at the bar and serving, but they couldn't do anything there. They couldn't eat, couldn't sleep. But the Lorraine, like I say, it was a bustling place. It was where doctors and lawyers and actors and entertainers came. Well, all of those, that's a mixed group of folks, business people. And they would come to the Lorraine. There was a big swimming pool outside. They would come and drink and smoke and, you know, have a good time. And they could stay. So it was one of the few where that was, this was a safe place to be able to interact.
after Martin Luther King's assassination, there was a weird disconnect in that the Lorraine kind of went downhill and went on.
Well, folks didn't want to stay here. They wanted to come and pay their respects. They almost turned it into a monument. It wasn't somewhere where they wanted to come and hang out,
right. You
know, to stay for a night. But they did want to recognize that this was where Dr. King was assassinated. They came in droves just to be in the place where he spent his final days. It went into financial ruins. It was going into, you know, foreclosure because they just couldn't keep it up. The business went down. Right after the assassination, it became a place where folks could stay for a day, you know. It became a residential place, renting rooms, that kind of thing. It was no longer a hotel or a motel. They added the hotel part so that they could have a restaurant. So if you are on Hewling, when you go on the side of the building and you see that sign that says, you know, steak and chicken, and
can tell
you how many people come asking, you know, want to make a reservation so they can eat here or stay here. Some folks still think this is a motel.
Right.
But that's what happened, is that they could not keep it as it was, a thriving motel / hotel, because folks did not want to stay here anymore. They wanted to pay their respects.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. That's pretty profound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talk to us about the movie, The Green Book. Did you see it?
Oh, my goodness. Of course I did. I was anxious to see it because I wanted... Whenever there's a movie that's about something historic, and I know that movies take lots of license, you know, so that folks can sit through it, I get it. So I wanted to see what this one did. You know, I was a fan of Selma because I felt it was so real and tied to what actually happened.
Yeah, I thought that was fascinating. I did not realize that was a real story, a true story.
Oh, no, it was a very true story. And that, you know, Jimmie Lee Jackson was a big deal. So in this one, when folks were, I mean, who knew about Shirley? Did you know about him before then?
No.
Well, me either, which is amazing. That's why movies like this are important, so that they give us some insight to all of these many. This is what this museum is about, these thousands of people. You know, everybody's got this one list of, you know, five people. Everybody knows the same five people, but there were thousands that did phenomenal things, and Mr. Shirley was one of them. I'm surprised this story didn't get out before now, but I'm glad it was told.
Yeah.
And I know they embellished on some stuff to make him more than he was, but you don't lose the thread of that here was a profound musician, one of the best of any race, doing what he was doing. And he was not treated special at all, you know, and he refused. He fought against it. Folks were shocked that he even wanted to do the South, understanding what was going on in the South for blacks. They could care less what your station is, you're in life, like what profession you're in or how good you were. It didn't matter. You were black. And so that's the way he was treated. And they were shocked when they asked for him to come because it was okay to be talented, but when you got through performing, you were still black. So you had to do what black people do. So that was the essence of the story. And it really did position the Green Book in a way that folks needed to know more. They needed to understand more. Folks were saying, what? This thing existed? Are you kidding? So now we have folks, just with the Selma movie, where folks are coming to see what happened on the bridge and all that. They come. The kids come. They're talking about it in school. Same thing is happening with the Green Book, where they want to see it. What is it? You know, did it exist? Is it real? And when we show them, it's a book.
Yeah.
It's an actual book. There's several of them. There were probably five or six versions of it. I think the last one was in, I know there was 1961, 1963, one in the 40s, 50s, 60s. You know, they just went on. So I'm glad that the story was told. It gives us, you know, more reason to talk about it more, to get people to just understand. These are all these different chapters that are in civil rights history. It's all these different chapters that kind of make you think, wow, are we still doing this? Is this something that's still happening?
You're in a real unique position. mm-hmm. the world comes to you, mm-hmm. school groups and kids mm-hmm. come to you. So in a way, the future generations, like a pulse beat, you see them, you feel them, mm-hmm. you hear them. All that being said, looking forward, are you optimistic or pessimistic? What do you see in the kids?
You know what I see in the kids? And this is an interesting generation. Mm-hmm. They're not passive at all. They call it as they see it.
Aren't you impressed with
I am very impressed. Yeah. And how well they talk about their frustrations, how well they talk about what they think is right and wrong, mm-hmm. how much they criticize their parents, whoever they think, mm-hmm. you know, is not doing, and each other. They're probably more real than I've seen in a little bit.
Yeah.
And they're thirsty for knowledge. That's always been something with young people. I mean, just wanting to know more. Mm-hmm. They come barreling in here, and a lot of them are reading more than what they're getting in their classrooms because, as I mentioned, it doesn't go as deep as we'd like for it to go, right?
So they're doing their own outside
Thank
research.
God for internet. Yeah. You know, it's a blessing and a curse. Mm-hmm. So they do have at their fingertips, you know, the ability to read into some of the things that they're interested in. You know, that they can dig deeper into the stories. And they also are not one that believe it because we tell them. They really want to know for sure that it's true.
All that being said, putting all those feelings and observations mm-hmm. together.
I'm optimistic that this generation is going to get it right. Mm-hmm. That we kind of lost a little ground. Mm-hmm. And this one is, when I say mad as hell and they're going to take it anymore, that's this group. Mm-hmm. They don't understand compliance, that they don't understand not fighting for what you want, that they don't understand why if my friend is black or my friend is Asian or my friend is whatever, mm-hmm. they don't, or white,
right.
they don't understand what's wrong with that.
But what, you see it every day in the lobby.
I see it every day. They're
the
hanging out
coming.
With each other. They're coming to the museum on a date. Something's different. When they want to be around this on a date.
and
getting a lot out of the visit. Mm-hmm. And then they go out in the courtyard and then they look up at the balcony and they want to understand, you know, what King was thinking when he was hanging out on the balcony, you know, as he did so much.
So that must make you feel good, fulfilled in a way for your mission. I mean, this has been your job, but it's also a mission and a life.
Well, it does make me feel good. It makes me feel encouraged. It makes me feel that all of the work that has been done to tell a story that everyone needs to hear. And this is storytelling, you know, from the perspective of the history makers, from the perspective of the activists, even the ones that were against the activists, you know, from a people that have been terrorized. You know, terrorism is not a new concept. You know, we act like it's something that just happens because of the Middle East. No. Terrorism has been going on in this country for as long as we can remember. So yes, it does put it in perspective that this is an important thing to do. It's an important thing to share. It's an important thing to push. It's an important thing to underline and underscore all the things that happened over all these years. And that it wasn't just one man that did it. You know, this museum started, certainly, because of his assassination. But it was the beginning of a movement to share what happened, you know, during this time. As a lesson, you know, you're doomed to repeat history if you don't know it, right? What we don't know is if that part's working.
Right.
But it's not because you're ignorant of it. It's not because you don't know or don't have the ability to find out. That doesn't exist any longer.
Okay, well, I could hug you all morning. I think I got to let you go.
Okay.
But Faith Morris, thank you so much for sharing. This has been a touching morning once again.
Yeah, it's great to see you again. Your memory is amazing. It's good to see you, and I'm glad that you're doing this. We really appreciate that you continue to be interested in the museum and to share what we're doing here.
It's my pleasure and my honor. I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Memphis, Tennessee.
And cornbread and butter beans, and you cross the table, eating them beans and making love as long as I am able.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world.
Waste of money. Come with me and stay with me and say you'll be my honey. And cornbread and butter beans and you cross the table. Eating them beans and I'm making love as long as I am able. Blowing corn and cotton too, and when the day is over, ride the mule and cut the fool and love begin all over.